can see that the street has been cleared in front of us, but we are absolutely stuck.
Marilyn Gutman tried to attend the mass anti-war demonstration that United for Peace and Justice organized in New York City on February 15, 2003. She describes her experience trying to protect her 5-year-old twin sons on February 15th when mounted police pushed into a crowded block of demonstrators.
I'm grabbing my son on the left that I see and want to get to my son on the right that I cannot see because there's someone on top of him and maybe others. And I'm, you know, thinking that he could suffocate or whatever.
Gutman's now-deceased husband was one of three named plaintiffs in a lawsuit brought against New York City this year by the New York Civil Liberties Union to limit certain police practices at political demonstrations. Gutman's family and tens of thousands of others never made it to the anti-war protest on First Avenue on February 15th. The police blocked off streets leading to the southern section of the demonstration, forcing people north and west away from the assembly area. Now, in the summer months leading up to the RNC, protest groups are working in the courts and on the ground to ensure that there is physical space for protest during and after the convention.
I think we're on our sixth attempt to continuously set up Bushville.
Sherry Hunkala is a longtime organizer working with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. In Jersey City, the group set up a tent city named after George W. Bush to highlight the effect of the administration's domestic policies on poor people.
Basically what Bushville is it's poor people in this country and our attempt to have our voice be heard. We have been setting up encampments for many years now, and we really believe that so-called Homeland Security and all the various different law enforcement agencies have been working round the clock to make sure that poor people are invisible.
Why are protesters having so much trouble getting access to abandoned lots and public streets in the New York metropolitan area? Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, describes the NYPD's total control approach to protests.
They feel that they have the need to micromanage almost every aspect of the demonstration, from how the behind the stage area gets set up to where you can have a demonstration and how many people are allowed in and what side of the street they have to be on, and this control with the use of barricades and protest pens and a kind of zero tolerance attitude for anything that goes outside of this total control model.
This zero tolerance approach has been catching on across the country with support from the federal government. President Bush sent $8.5 million to Miami to back up police during protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas in November of last year. And as the G8 summit took place off the coast of Georgia this spring, the security force of 20,000 dwarfed the 300 protesters who showed up. NYPD and Boston police officials were taking notes in Georgia. Now Boston is stocking up on riot gear and recently announced that police will conduct random searches of passenger bags on subways and trains during the DNC in late July. In this climate of increased policing, activists are hoping to get permission for demonstrations of their own design. United for Peace and Justice and seven other groups are being represented in permit negotiations by Christopher Dunn of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
There has been no good explanation as to why the police department has taken so long to move on these applications.
Dunn says further lawsuits haven't been ruled out if the police department will not issue march permits. Currently, the NYPD is offering group stationary rally permits for 8th Avenue near Madison Square Garden, where the convention will take place, but they haven't granted permission for any marches. Dunn is also lead counsel in the NYCLU suit for an injunction to end certain police practices at demonstrations. These include restrictions on access to protest pens, the use of horses, and the searching of people trying to attend protests. The issue of pens is particularly contentious.
There are many, many groups that would like to see the pens abolished altogether. In this litigation, we are not seeking a complete abolition of the pens. The police department has legitimate concerns about regulating crowds at events. And while we do not like the pens, the thing about the pens that we think is clearly illegal are the complete lack of access into and out of the pens, and the overly restrictive limits the pens is now used by the department imposed upon protest activity.
The NYCLU called Leslie Kagan of United for Peace and Justice as a witness during its trial this June before Federal District Court Judge Robert Sweet. She points to the tension between legal and activist strategies to protect protest.
The suit calls for an what should I say, a kinder, more gentle use of those pens. And maybe, and that was a legal strategy. I'm not a lawyer. You know, I can't judge whether or not that's a good legal strategy or not. As an organizer, though, I think you always push for what you really want, and then you retreat to a compromise position. You don't start with the compromise position.
Though legal strategies are often more conservative than activist objectives, they can determine precedent in the courts for decades to come. Sociologist Alex Vitali says that legal strategies cannot be understood in a political vacuum.
The legal stuff only makes sense in the context of political activity, so that it's an arm of an overall strategy. So what we have at the current moment is not only lawsuits against the city, but the threat of future large demonstrations that may or may not be willing to go along with what the police have in mind.
Lawyers for the City of New York said repeatedly in the court hearings that restricting the NYPD's tactics at demonstrations would hamper police ability to prevent terrorism. But Dunn said the terrorism imperative broke down during the testimony of city witness Joseph Esposito, the highest-ranking uniformed police officer in New York.
The chief of the police department, Joseph Esposito, testified at trial that none of the reforms that we are seeking would in any way undermine the police department's law enforcement interests or its concerns about terrorism. And that disposes of it. The city lawyers want to make that argument, but the head of the police department has said that it's not true, and that's good enough for us.
Whether or not Judge Sweet grants the injunction sought by the NYCLU, protesters will face massive police presence at demonstrations during the RNC. And in the ongoing negotiations to obtain permits, organizers say the city is infringing on their constitutional rights to assembly by agreeing to grant permits only for demonstrations held in the designated protest pit. Leslie Kagan.
The message that we're getting from the police department in particular and other city officials is that our right to protest has been reduced to our right to apply for a permit, which is very different than your right to protest.
Some groups plan to march and rally whether or not their permit applications come through, and a general call has gone out for civil disobedience on August 31st during the convention. So while activist lawyers work the courts, in the end it will be protesters who take the First Amendment into the streets in late August. Hunkala of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign.
Regardless of the fact if we're given permission or not, we're a nonviolent, peaceful group of people who want to talk about real serious issues, and we will march on August 30th at 4 o'clock from in front of the United Nations.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in New York.